This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
Hi, this is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast. I'm here with Martin. How are you doing, Martin?
Hey, Chris. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thanks. Not too bad. Back from a little bit of travel, but heading off again tomorrow.
Ah, good for you. Nice and autumnal here. Don't know what it's like where you are, but yeah.
The leaves are falling off everywhere. Not the leads, but the leaves are falling off everywhere. Yeah. So I've got a bit of gardening work to go and clear that up when I get back.
Well, hopefully it will rain, then. You don't have to do it.
Yeah, that's a good excuse, isn't it? So this week, it's just you and me. And we thought we'd go off and, well, and in fact, I was trying to think, how long is it since it's just been the two of us recording?
It's been a while. And we head to the end of the year, this topic you've picked, Chris, seems to be one of those end of year topics, which is a pretty good one.
Let's get on to it, and we'll talk about the particular subject matter we're going to talk about this week, and that is, how do you make money in storage? Now, I'm not talking about those big yellow buildings where people keep all their stuff that they don't need anymore. What do you call them? Storage warehouses or those sort of lockups, or that sort of thing. I'm not talking about that sort of storage, but we're talking about how do storage vendors make money in the current market? And clearly the most obvious reason for that being, we think that storage gets cheaper and cheaper year on year. So we thought it'd be great to have a look at what the challenges are for the vendors in the market, what assumptions there are that we all assume around the pricing and how they make their money, and what vendors are doing to move it forward. So let's just talk about a little bit about the struggle of the vendors and some of the challenges that they see in the market. Now, we've talked over the last, 3 or 4 months about vendor consolidations. We've talked about drops in revenue. It's not an easy time for the storage vendors, I would say, Martin.
No, it's not. We're going to be sympathetic today towards them.
Well, do you know, somebody said to me I wasn't very sympathetic about IBM, and you were more sympathetic about IBM in one of our recent podcasts. So I have a feeling I'm not going to be massively sympathetic.
Well, okay. Yeah, it does seem to be a tough market, certainly for traditional vendors, and even sort of some of the new entrants, people like Pure, are beginning to see drops in revenue. So yeah, I think I do have some sympathies. How do they take this traditional business, which is basically been selling as much storage as possible for as much money as possible, into something which is more sustainable with all the new entries and all the competition which is happening at the moment?
Yeah, so we've seen, obviously, consolidation. We've seen, as you said, some drops in revenue from Pure and NetApp. Some of that might be attributable, if possible, to China and the trade deals in the US. Other vendors don't seem to have been affected by that, so it's difficult to see whether that's the case. But I think Pure did say that one of their issues was that the reduction in price of NAND flash had caused them a bit of a problem, but they saw that coming around. We'll talk about how they're dealing with that in a little while. But there's been a lot of change in the industry in general, I would say. For example, you know, the fact that hardware is good enough for any of us to build our own storage platform.
Yeah, but that's probably been the case for some time, but it's been good enough to build your own storage environment or build your own storage array. And we're seeing it across the field now. It's not just storage. I mean, if you actually look at a lot of vendors were subsidizing their storage revenues by making a lot of money out of sand, for instance. And we're seeing although I believe number of sand ports is holding steady, but the price of a sand port has dropped as well. So I think the traditional vendors certainly are more and more pressured all the time.
Yeah, what about media? Hard drives, without a doubt, for many, many years have been commodity, but we're seeing all of that push towards being, for certainly the hard drive market, we're seeing the falling away of the performance drives, and vendors are only making money out of capacity. And it seems that in order to get the capacities into drives, it's getting harder and harder to achieve that at the higher end, I think.
Yeah, so if we look at the traditional hard drive, traditional hard drive is probably a long and interesting topic to talk about at some point. Because recently, I mean, certainly over the last 2 years, I'd say, we'd seen a plateauing in capacity, and now it seems to be about to take off again. But certainly we've seen the death of the performance drives. I don't even believe you could buy a 10K drive, certainly from an array manufacturer these days. We'll still see 7.2s, and certainly 15K drives are non-existent. So we're seeing that all shifting down.
Yeah, and part of that obviously is the move towards flash. But even then, the flash market has started to follow the same trend as hard drives. So we see the market wanting to push the capacity of devices to make more money out of capacity, you know, being able to charge per dollar per gigabyte. But also, to be honest, the price has dropped because we've seen cheaper technology for TLC and QLC. So there's that progression in that market as well. There's not still a market for high-end expensive flash.
I do wonder what we're seeing in a refresh as well, because if you look at the flash market especially, for many companies, the last generation of flash was good enough. So the desire to refresh, certainly for any technical reason, is going away. And it's never really been a technical reason to refresh. But some of these drives are so reliable. I just wonder if people are beginning to think, you know what, I'll drop my support levels. I don't worry so much about it. And then if you start dropping your support levels, the business case for refresh starts to fall away.
That in itself is a really interesting discussion, because for many, many years, I would say that the vendors would come back to us and say, you should refresh that hard drive array because those hard drives are expensive in terms of power and cooling and space. If you put in this system, which has got drives which are four times the capacity, you know, especially when we went from those lower capacities to the sort of middling capacities, I would say, you could almost justify a refresh because of the TCO around the cost saving of power and cooling and everything else. So that doesn't seem to me to be as aggressive and as easy to achieve in flash. And I think that's the problem you're highlighting effectively.
Yeah. So for a lot of companies now, they're coming up for their first flash refresh. Generally refresh after 4 years, and we're now really seeing the dominance of all flash, certainly in traditional compute workloads. It will be very interesting to see how much refresh people see, and obviously the reason to refresh, it really won't be a technology driven refresh for almost anybody. It will be, okay, your year 5 maintenance costs or your year 6 maintenance costs horrendous. That's the only reason to do it.
Right, so let's park that thought when we talk about strategies for selling in a little while. But in the meantime, I want to just add one little point to this as part of the discussion, and that's around open source and how much we think that's had an impact on this part of the market.
You know what? I'm not convinced it has had an impact.
And I maybe should qualify that, shouldn't I, really? We tend to talk about enterprise storage. We don't talk about consumer. Yep. We don't necessarily talk about environments where people might be building evaluation or test systems in a sandbox type model. We're talking about customers who are enterprise based, who are putting in production systems that run mission critical apps. And I think in that context, possibly open source just isn't as impactful as it might have been in other areas.
Yeah, I don't think it has been as impactful. I think we've seen an impact of open source, but open source impact is completely indirect for most people. It's for hyperscalers who are using open source. That's where you've probably seen the impact, really. So it's that shift. It's a hidden impact. Open source isn't the driver. It's, well, it may be a driver, but it's underneath the covers. It's a changing market.
Yeah, true. And I guess that's something, again, we'll touch on in a little while. But you're right. Maybe that's where we should we should compartmentalize the idea of open source, is that it may well be indirectly having an impact. Okay, let's just talk about some of the assumptions that when we look at vendors and how we think they might make their money. Now, the most obvious one is to think that everything's priced up on a dollar per gigabyte price, and that dollar per gigabyte price is trending towards zero. And therefore, how can they make any money out of the hardware that they sell? You would expect them to make, hopefully, without before overheads, before, you know, just on gross margin, maybe 60-70%, because they've got to fund development, they've got to fund development of new products and research and everything else. So as the dollars per gigabyte price reduces, do we still think vendors make as much money?
I don't think they make anywhere near as much money as they used to. Certainly the traditional vendors are shipping to enterprises, but I don't think the margins are there. So they may make a lot of money in the same way a supermarket makes a lot of money, but it really is a case of much lower margins. Well, that's my gut feel at the moment.
Yeah, supermarkets, and I know that when I worked for Tesco a long time ago, a very short period of time, many, many years ago, and I think at the time then, they were on 6% margins or less. I think it's much less now, as far as I'm aware. So that's a really tight margin, but it is a multi-billion dollar business, I suppose. That's the way they work it, don't they? But you've got to be pretty good with your business model to make money at 6%.
Yeah, so the storage vendors are nowhere near that. They're going to be making tens of percent, but probably not as much as they were used to. So you can start to see how they make money is by cutting costs elsewhere. So I don't think it's any particular secret. You talk to any enterprise customer, they'll tell you that the support organizations of all the major vendors are nowhere near as good as they used to be. Now, there are a couple of reasons for that, but I think that's because the price has been squeezed and maybe some products are more reliable. They're not seeing the engineers being out as busy. Maybe they feel an engineer can cover a larger territory by themselves as opposed to having half a dozen engineers. You only need two engineers now.
Maybe some of that, and this is another part of the discussion where we talk about strategies to a certain degree, but maybe some of that is the reliability of the platforms and some of the additional technology we've seen from vendors like HPE with InfoSight, where the actual reliability of the product has been vastly increased because of the additional information they're getting from many, many customers. And that's allowing them to put boxes into the field that are so much more reliable and can be updated in the field, patched, aren't running custom components. You know, the hardware isn't something very specific that the vendor has designed, and therefore it's a much easier support model, perhaps, and a more under support model are supported by software.
Well, it used to be the case that you'd have a hardware engineer which come out and they would be specialized on a couple of products, say a Symmetrix back in the day, and maybe a Clarion or something like that. But these days, the hardware engineers, the field engineers for most vendors, are expected to be able to work on a complete product set from storage arrays through to PCs. And if you look at it, the skills are very, very similar now, and the hardware is very similar. So yeah, so a hardware engineer can work on many different types. So, but they certainly don't have the depth of knowledge as they used to have.
Okay. Let's go back and talk about the dollar per gigabyte price again for a second and think about whether the increase in media size, so the fact that we're now at 16 terabyte drives, I don't know whether you're pricing up 16 terabyte drives yet, but at that sort of capacity, if you actually look at the cost of those drives, they're not cheap if you bought them even just retail. So do we think the dollar per gigabyte reduction is effectively swallowed up by increases in capacity?
It might be. See, I'm not convinced by what the buy price of some of the large vendors are on 16. So we see in the retail, we don't see them. So 16 terabyte drive is expensive-ish. I do wonder if some of the large vendors are actually buying at a lot cheaper price than that. Because I think the hard drive manufacturers themselves are struggling. So they may be trying to make money out of consumers.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay, so you think that there's a chance that we might be paying more as a consumer for a drive as a retail cost than somebody like EMC who buys 100 million drives a year or something like that.
I think there could well be something in that.
Yeah, that's an interesting argument because we don't really know, and I certainly don't know, what the price is that vendors are paying for the technology at the bottom end here. So they could be making a lot more margin than we possibly give them credit for.
Yeah, so it may be healthier than we realise. I mean, if you look at the commercial side of things, you'll be looking at it. If you're looking at the consumer side, you may be thinking that actually those vendors are really struggling, but maybe they're paying a lot less.
Okay.
I'm fairly certain they pay a lot less for flash.
Unless somebody can tell us different or can advise us, I guess, you know, it's a reasonable assumption. But let's talk about that, you know, the flash and the hard drive market and where we think that whole thing's going. Because in one respect, I think the assumption everybody tells us is that the biggest growth area is in unstructured. And unstructured immediately says to me cheap because it's content that you may not be using all the time. But funny enough, at the NetApp analyst event at Insight last month, one of the VPs, can't remember which one it was that said it, he said on stage that they are seeing an increase in the growth of SAN. Not only that, but they're bringing out a dedicated SAN product. So they're taking an ONTAP solution, stripping out all the file services and selling it purely as a block device. So they're seeing an increase in SAN. And you said that a minute ago. I thought that was really interesting.
That doesn't surprise me. I have some ideas about that. And you did a really interesting piece of work on your blog about the cost of Amazon storage and the fact that it hasn't declined. It's getting to the stage, well, certainly if you're a large enterprise, where if you start comparing the costs of storing stuff in the cloud as opposed to storing stuff on premises, the cloud is starting to look very expensive. And the premise of the cloud is it is elastic. Well, tell me the last time you actually felt that a storage install or a storage environment was elastic. It's elastic in that it goes one way. It gets bigger. It never gets smaller. And you can't just turn it off. If you've got data, it will sit there. It's not like compute sitting in the cloud. You just run a compute when you need it, and then you turn it back off again. Your data is going to sit there. So you really do find yourself comparing a four-year cost for storing stuff in the cloud compared to the four-year cost of buying something. So I think there's a number of large enterprises and probably medium enterprises as well who begin to look at the storage side of things and think, I'm not sure that cloud really does it for me, because there's no concept of burst capacity in storage. Not really. You burst into it and you never come back out of it again. So you might as well keep your data on premises if you can and move it up into the cloud for the ephemeral compute workloads. And as long as you're not generating huge amounts of data to come back again, that seems to be the perfect way to do it. So I can see that people will start building scale-out environments based on cheap and deep SAN.
Okay. And what do you mean by cheap and deep SAN? Are you thinking that will be flash or combination of flash and hard drives, perhaps? What's your sort of view on how that might look?
I think a lot of that will be hard drive, because for your high performance side of things, you're going to shift that into cloud, because that's where your ephemeral workloads may well be. So you just move it across, you do your compute, you move back your results, and you delete your environment. That's where your thermal environments will be. But it was structured data has a habit of hanging around like a bad smell. Nobody wants to delete it, fear of deletion and all that. If you have a fear of deleting, don't put it in a cloud. Your OPEX costs are just going to get larger and larger and larger.
I do agree with you, and I think that's a really interesting point to raise, and that's the difference between different parts of the cloud infrastructure in terms of the different services that you might consume and how long they last when you use them. So that idea that when people think, oh, you can just scale up, scale down, great for compute, and there might well be plenty of scenarios where one week you've got a team of developers who are doing something and they run something for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, and then they blow that environment away and they start again and do something else. Or you might have some peaks and troughs of workload that come in because of the way that your business works. But the point you made there about the data that you're looking after is you can't reduce that amount of data. There's no peaks and troughs in data in that similar sense. So you are genuinely looking at what's going to cost me to store this thing for 4 years or whatever, which, you know, whatever your standard on-premises hardware life cycle would be. And that, you're right, it does look really expensive when you get to that point.
I know people listening probably say, well, what about Glacier? Well, Glacier's great, but it does mean that if you keep all your data in Glacier, for instance, and yeah, then you can start getting it down to a price of an on-premises storage solution. It's still very much of a wash. Obviously, it's complicated because working out the cost of ownership of your on-premises solution, you've got data center costs, you've got environmentals. But if you've got all your data in Glacier and then suddenly you decide that you want to run a workload in Azure or GCP or Alibaba, you've got an egress cost. You've got to move it into that cloud. So you may have a single hop. You may even have a double hop to move this around. So if you want a data neutrality or a big pool of data, which you're going to choose where you're going to run your compute, you're going to keep it on premises.
Yeah. One of the bits I'd add to that is that whole idea that the very top of our discussion here. And we were talking about the idea of when you get to year three, year four, maintenance costs and what it costs from a vendor. One of the things that I do like about the on-premises model is that I've got the ability to sweat that asset if I get to year three and think I'm happy to pay a bit more of a license charge, or I'm happy not to pay any license charge on this data whatsoever for that particular platform. And if it fails, it fails. You know, I'll take some risks. You don't get the equivalent in the cloud. The cost is the same cost every month, apart from whatever declining cost the vendor's putting into that. Your cost base is consistent. And that's a bad thing in some respects, because at least on-prem, you can sort of squeeze that asset a bit more if you really have to, and you don't have to go and buy that new array in year three or year four. You could wait till year seven. And that may be where, with flash, that becomes even more possible to do.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it gives you that flexibility of deciding what you want to pay, and you can put value on data and say, you know what, that data's got some value, but I don't care that much about it. I'll run it on a much low level of support. I can do things with support levels or run it completely out of support.
Yeah,
I could even start putting stuff in stores. I can go to eBay and get parts if I want to. So I can fix it myself. And that's a very viable option for a lot of large enterprises, certainly for test environments or environments where you're not that worried about it. Whereas if you stop paying your fees to your cloud provider, well, your data's gone.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Let's move on and talk about vendors, because we were going to talk about how vendors make money out of this.
Yeah.
And the first one we've clearly highlighted is the fact that the cloud guys are making money out of it. If they've got people who are putting stuff in the cloud that they're charging them month by month, the longer that they can charge somebody for that data that's sitting in the cloud without having to refresh the technology that they're using to put that onto, they're continuing to get better margin out of their assets month on month, year on year. So in actual fact, one of the things we're seeing is, number one, let's start with that one. We're seeing both vendors that are in the cloud, like the native cloud providers. We're seeing vendors trying to put technology next to the cloud and change the model to a SaaS model, an OPEX model. And also we're seeing vendors who are partnering with the cloud providers like NetApp to put their technology into the cloud and make money that way. So how much money do you think people are making out of using those techniques of going to the cloud?
I don't think we're making a lot of money yet. I think they might. I can see possibilities of them making a reasonable amount of money. It really depends how fast some of these companies moving to cloud. And for instance, if you run a NetApp ONTAP in the cloud, there may be a good reason to do it, but you can keep all your processes the same, whether you're running on-premises or you're running in the cloud. So that's very attractive, and it's probably a very attractive thing for NetApp themselves to do. I imagine their margins are pretty good on that, because they're really just going to be selling a service or just selling software at this point. So does hardware become less and less important and you're just selling software?
Yeah, so I was thinking the same. Now, what I was going to say to you was, I'm not 100% sure of the NetApp model, But initially, from memory, they said that it would be put on probably dedicated custom equipment. But over time, they'd modify the OS, the ONTAP OS, so that it could be run on Amazon hardware. Now, at that point, Amazon provide the hardware. All that's happening there is NetApp provide a license for their software, and they spend their time refreshing it. Compare that, for example, to GCP, where you saw Elastifile go there. Elastifile runs entirely on existing GCP virtual instances and so on. So there's actually no hardware deployment there whatsoever. So really, if you're a vendor of that technology, all you've got to do is sell a license into the cloud provider. And yes, you might not get the same margin you got on-prem, but you're still probably going to be quite well off because you're not having to do anything.
I think they'd get upset if you suggest that they're not doing anything. But
yeah. Okay.
That's a fair point. And actually, obviously, you're not providing hardware. That's of a value on money wise. Your licensing costs actually become almost a pure profit. Well, not necessarily 100% profit, but you're not paying a lot of money for having field engineers, as I was talking about earlier. But you don't need all those, because all that will be managed from the cloud provider.
Yeah, okay. I redact the fact that I said doing nothing. What I meant was it wouldn't be things like the field organization. There'd be less support. They probably will train up people that sit within the cloud provider to do first, second, maybe even third level support to a certain degree. There'll be a lot of offloading of their old tasks that they don't have to do. So it's a much more streamlined model, let's call it, than it would be if they were supporting an on-premises solution. So and it's not just those guys. There are lots of other people who are trying to sell storage as just software as well. You know, you can look across the market and there's tons of vendors that offer similar solutions.
There are, and there's a lot of vendors who are trying to work out how they license a hybrid. That's where I think that some vendors will be looking to make money. How do you use hybrid cloud? So you have a mixture of on-premises and off-premises. And for some of vendors, this is a really good approach for them, because they can sell some hardware, but actually potentially a bulk of their software will be, bulk of their sales will be software licensing, because you'll be licensing capacity in the cloud. In fact, they're not even worried about having to deal with a cloud provider. They're just selling an interface which will talk to S3 or an Amazon EBS and do things like that. So I think maybe some of the vendors are going to make quite a lot of money out of hybrid.
One example of that could be Pure. Pure have just announced Cloud Block Storage, or Cloud Block Store, which is basically a number of virtual instances running in AWS, which together looks like a virtual array. But then you have to license the Purity operating system on top of that. Now, if you have Evergreen, which is their perpetual licensing solution, you can take some of your on-prem Evergreen license and use it in the cloud. But you don't get any discount for doing that. And that means that Pure potentially quids in, because now they don't have to sell you the hardware. You're paying for the virtual hardware sitting in your Amazon account, and then they just put their license on top. So the margin there is significantly better for them. And if other vendors follow suit, then yeah, that could be a real a way to make a lot more money out of things. Right, let's move on and talk about another one. How about just selling more stuff? How many vendors could we look at and say that economy of scale could be a solution for this? Does that seem like a reasonable way to go forward?
I do think for the big boys, we keep talking about the growth in unstructured data. So I think for those, so many of the bigger vendors, that's basically what they're going to do. Pile it high, sell it cheap. And as we say, live off very thin margins, take almost like a supermarket style. And as companies bring their own software stack on top, or we see more DevOps or SRE type practices put in, so the software which they're running on these devices doesn't need to be particularly complicated anymore. A lot of people are just looking for block. All they want is block. Mm-hmm. They may want snaps. They probably don't want replication. They don't care about replication. They'll be doing it in their own, should be doing it in software, whether it's application level or they're using technologies like DataGuard or the equivalent in SQL Server. So they can simplify their stack. It's yet again, it's another way they can make money, because they may need less developers.
Yeah, I wonder whether pilot high, sell and cheap is a real long-term strategy in the sense that it's an easy market to compete in, because it then just becomes a question of how efficient you are of going to the wholesaler, if you like, and buying stuff. If you have either a partner of somebody like Seagate or Western Digital, or you are them in the first place, then you'd think that they would be able to produce the cheapest solution. So it seems to me that that, as a long-term strategy, might not necessarily be a good way of working.
I'm not sure any of them have a long-term strategy at the moment. Long-term in the storage market for some of these guys is 3 years. I don't think anybody has any more than that. It was interesting, we had that sort of Twitter exchange where Enrico mentioned something about innovation, and I just don't think we've seen any innovation in the storage market properly for the past 3 or 4 years. People point at things, and there's no innovation. It's incremental improvements. It's nothing dramatic. We've not seen anything. So where you've got a market where innovation is not, it's probably not easy, and it's not common, it will go up. I think you have the lowest common denominator, and that will be cost. So you'll be selling more stuff, but accepting the fact you're going to live off thinner margins.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about Flash then. We talked about that earlier. What about moving your business so that you get a lot more sales from what is seen as a more premium product like Flash? It seems to be that maybe that's not as profitable as we might think. You sort of, you know, we talked about the fact that we're seeing a move from relatively expensive Flash towards QLC and TLC, which potentially are higher capacity but cheaper products. And that seems to follow the same problem that hard drives had, that you end up with a dollar per gigabyte decline, and therefore you can't make as much money.
The flash market has become a dollar per gigabyte market. I think there's no doubt in that. I mean, some of the new entries may want to dispute that and will try and change it, but it is a dollar per gigabyte. And as we've seen, the reliability or people understanding more about consumer flash or consumer plus or prosumer flash, the array manufacturers are going to start down that way, to start using some of the cheaper flash. We understand a lot more about the performance characteristics and reliability. Yeah, we still see differences. We still see in a server, people will sell write intensive versus read intensive flash, with your read intensive flash being cheaper because it doesn't have to be quite as reliable. It's not going to have so many array cycles. But yeah, I think this is where we see it. I mean, remember when EMC first started shipping, was it SLC?
In a DMX,
and how eye-watering that was. It was ridiculously expensive, and we've seen that come down very, very quickly in price.
Yeah, to the extent that you could look back and say, I don't know, when some of the first technology from, say, Violin was out, it was probably being charged at $20 a gig, that sort of price.
Yeah.
Maybe more. Gosh, you wouldn't consider paying that these days, would you?
No, not at all. I was, funny enough, watching a funny little video this morning from Linus Tech Tips, and he was talking about a product which was designed to go in PCs, about to reuse your DDR, which was just a gigabyte made at a board which you could put your RAM in and turn it into some kind of performance device. And it never took off. It was far too expensive. An SSD is now so much cheaper, but there's no reason to do it for most people. SCM will come along. The impact of SCM on the market will be interesting.
Okay, so we never really talked about that as a scenario, actually. That's a very, very interesting one, in the sense that there are lots of other technologies that are coming along. I mean, I think I said flash initially, but of course, there are other solid-state memory products that are coming afterwards, like Optane, which is your 3D Crosspoint, which is now being sold by Micron as well, I think, as of next year. They've announced that. Quantex or whatever it's called. But there's plenty of others. So there's MRAM, there's Everspin with their solutions, and we've seen those go into products to make them work a bit quicker, or to make them to, you know, add caching or whatever it happens to be. So there is that opportunity, I guess, to develop hybrid products that potentially mix and match some of this technology to counteract some of the cost, but actually not hit some of the negatives of those products, like, you know, the endurance and things like that. So it's to help the endurance without actually massively increasing the cost. So that, I think you're right. I think that could be a very interesting area to watch.
The hybrid market, this idea is these hybrid type of devices, this doesn't really help some of the more traditional storage vendors, the single product, the pure play storage vendors, because to make that hybrid market work properly, that's got to integrate nicely with a server. And if you're not owning the whole stack within an environment, that becomes harder. Your qualification process becomes much more complicated as well.
Okay, park that one for a second. We'll come back to that in a minute. So, okay, we've said then you could sell more stuff. You could move to Flash. You could just sell it as software in the cloud or on-prem. But part of that change in terms of selling stuff on-prem could be to change your business model. So rather than selling a box every 3 years to a customer, you sell a subscription service based on a consumption model, or even go the whole hog and say, I'll sell this entirely as a service. And we'll support the box on-prem for the customer, and potentially we can charge a higher premium, but the customer might be happy with the OPEX model because that suits them more. I'm not fully on board with how these models would really work, I have to say.
I think what you might see is you'll see a subscription service based around the software, but with still with a refresh model, a traditional, more traditional model around the hardware. So you'll buy a license to use for the software, which you'll pay a license cost every year. And then it will be a case that you'll have a different model for your hardware. But we certainly see this happen more and more as a line item. you don't pay maintenance on an array as an entirety. You'll pay a part of it based on the software license and part of it based on the hardware. That's not especially new, but I know many of the vendors are working out how they leverage that more to make it more attractive. And some of this is aimed, obviously, at making sure that they're appearing in the statistics, so they're shipping more and more capacity. And if you reduce the friction of shipping hardware, that means you can be, at least be seen to be top of the table. We've shipped 5 exabytes this quarter. But actually, what they're really doing is just selling more and more disks. They're not actually selling any more software. Or if they are, it's the license model is set in a different way. So it's all about reducing the friction of that sale and capacity increases.
Okay. All right. Let's move on and talk about the whole idea of the solution side of it then, because this, I think, has got two angles to it. So first of all, you could look at it and say some of the bigger vendors shouldn't be a pure play storage company, and it might be better off being an end-to-end stack solution provider. We, I guess, saw the development of CI and HCI as solutions to try and get around some of that. But we still see Pure, we still see NetApp as being what you might call possibly the only two standalone storage companies out there of any size. I know there are others, but I'm just trying not to come up with a huge list. Now, as part of that, is there value add in owning that infrastructure end to end in the ecosystem? And secondly, when you look at the features that those vendors have started to add, you start to see some significant value add. I'll give you some examples. HPE's InfoSight, Pure Storage with Pure One, NetApp with ActiveIQ, all aimed at helping you manage that environment, reduce your operational costs, and try and make life easier for you from a storage perspective, but also with some of those solutions going higher up the stack. So how much of this actually really will work for a single standalone company, and how many of them should try and become bigger companies?
See, HPE InfoSight, when it was Nimble, I'm still convinced HPE bought Nimble for InfoSight, because InfoSight's a really interesting and a great product and customers loved it. But InfoSight's value now is expanding across the whole estate. So it's not just their storage arrays, it's how it integrates into their server estate. So the InfoSight value proposition becomes much stronger. Pure One and ActiveIQ, it's still about managing storage. People want to manage environments, they don't want to manage storage.
Yep, I'll give you a cloud comparison. So you'd expect, if you were looking at your cloud environment, to have a dashboard which showed you how everything works. You know, is my cloud environment running? Have I got issues with performance in storage? Have I got issues with spinning up virtual instances? You name it, whatever it happens to be. Networking, you'd expect to see a joined up dashboard. So it seems to be that when I look at it, I read a book recently, and one of the things it talked about in that was, this is from like the 1980s, quite old, and it talked about the owning of the ecosystem. So a prime example of that have been IBM from the 1960s, the 1970s, when they owned the mainframe, they owned the standards for the mainframe. Anybody who wanted to compete with IBM had to play catch up and develop products after IBM had released them into the market. And because they owned that entire environment, they could dictate how that market developed. And I look at some of the vendors now and think, are they trying to do the same thing? So Nutanix with their structure, VMware with all the stuff that they've just announced, and vendors like HPE that have had traditional products, are they trying to extend that lock-in? Not, I use the word lock-in, I don't mean it in a negative sense, but are they trying to get that lock-in across their platforms by using tools like InfoSight, because that gives much greater value than going and buying those components separately?
Yeah, I think they are. I think that there is a move towards this. Yeah, you can still buy best of breed if you want. But however, if you stick with our stuff, you will get this management tool. This will allow you a much better management experience, agility. You don't have any, potentially, you have less problems, interoperability problems. So it's always been a promise from dealing with a large vendor which did everything that you would get this. But I think things like InfoSight actually really start to deliver on that vision.
And I think it's a step more, isn't it? Because it's not just a case of saying, I'll give you a single GUI where you can do management, and I might call individual element managers to go and deliver some of that. It's actually bringing both management and the reporting and the analytics about the platform together to give you a much more joined up view about what's going on. And when you're changing some of the components that relate to, say, VM performance, you can actually change the storage to make sure that the two of those work together. So you actually get a much more, for want of a better word, holistic view of the environment. So I think it is definitely something different to what we've seen in the past. But it does beg the question, those companies that are still, let's call them pure play storage companies, is there still value to that? Now, to pick on NetApp as an example of that, NetApp have tried to go off into the HCI route because maybe they've seen that that's something else they have to offer.
I'm not quite sure I really understand NetApp's HCI strategy at the moment. But I think they do realise they need to change. They need to become, or cover more bases.
But that doesn't help Pure at all, does it, in that instance? Because they haven't done the same. They've partnered and they've got CI-type solutions and some application-specific ones like Airy. But in general, they haven't got, like, they're not a server company, they're not an apps company. So they're very much still a storage company, even though they might partner with other people.
Yeah, so Pure and NetApp are very similar companies. Or Pure looked like NetApp did probably 10 years ago, and not necessarily in a bad way. But the market has changed, and I think with the emergence of the cloud providers, so people are looking for companies which can do it all, and that's the point of the cloud providers.
Yeah, and maybe that is the ultimate scenario, that if you really want to make more money in storage, maybe you have to look outside of just storage, and maybe just storage as a component to building solutions for people that meet their requirements on a much broader basis.
Yeah.
Oh, well, do you think that's the conclusion of our discussion today?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, okay, I agree with you. I think whilst I enjoyed seeing new storage technologies come to the market and be developed, and we see those companies obviously potentially doing well and they might get it acquired, I'm not sure whether the long-term strategy for anybody is to be a pure play storage company anymore. And I do think people are much more focused on solutions and ecosystems rather than purely on the storage platform itself.
Well, we have discussed this, Chris. We do believe that at least for some companies, their exit is to get acquired by a hyperscaler. So
yeah, that is true. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
everybody's exit in the past was to be try and be acquired by HPE or IBM or Dell or EMC. Yeah. Now people are looking at Google and Amazon and maybe Microsoft as a potential acquirer of their company. And that's why we're seeing most of this development carrying on in software, because software transfers nicely into these hyperscale environments.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Brilliant. On that note, I think we'll wrap up there and say like as always, we keep an eye on the market and see where we are in another 12 months' time. But it'll be very interesting to see how those models develop and how things change in terms of the business models we've seen develop recently and ongoing. But for now, Martin, thanks for joining me. Great to chat as always, and look forward to catch up soon.
Yeah. Cheers, mate.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.